Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm Ann Harper, your guest host for this evening. Tonight we'll be talking about fracking farmland. What could possibly go wrong? Everyone knows that California is an agricultural powerhouse, that we produce nearly half the country's fruits, vegetables, and nuts. What everyone may not know is that we also produce more oil than Alaska these days. We're consistently ranked third or fourth in the country for oil production. And both of these industries have been operating side by side in the Central Valley for about a century or more, relatively peacefully, until with the drought and increasing pressure on groundwater supplies and new technologies and numerous chemicals being used for oil extraction, it's become clear that our groundwater, which is so essential, especially during a drought for both crops and people, is under a very real threat of contamination. Joining me here in the studio to talk about this is Matt Heberger. Matt is a senior research associate in the water program of the Pacific Institute, a water policy think tank in Oakland, where he conducts research on water resources policy, planning, and management. He is also the lead author of a recent study we'll be discussing entitled Oil, Food, and Water, Challenges and Opportunities for California Agriculture. Welcome, Matt.
Good evening. Pleasure to be here.
Also joining me in the studio is Andrew Grinberg. Andrew is the Oil and Gas Program Manager in the California Office of Clean Water Action. Andrew works on California oil and gas policy with a focus on state legislation, regulation, and public engagement. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And last but not least is Miriam Rockin-Ellman, Staff Scientist in the Health Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Welcome, Miriam.
Great to be here.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134, or you could email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or on our Facebook page at City Visions. We'll invite you to participate later on in the program. Right now, Matt, let's start with you. The Pacific Institute recently released this study, which detailed numerous threats that the oil industry poses to our food supply and the agricultural industry. I want to get much of what you covered in that study, but let's start with the link between these two industries. How is agriculture affected by the oil industry's activities?
Well, in a number of different ways. So in California's Central Valley, you've had oil and agriculture have lived side by side for 100 years, often peacefully. And I think there's some cracks are starting to appear in the relationship between these two industries. They compete for land is one thing that we found. And increasingly, farmers are becoming more concerned about potential contamination of soil and water that their crops depend on and that their livestock depend on. And so that's why we decided to take a more detailed look at some of the challenges that these industries could pose to one another, and as well as the opportunities. And so really what we identified as the biggest challenge is the threat of water contamination. And there's been some high-profile lawsuits in the last couple of years where farmers had the disposal of wastes from the oil industry that were dumped into unlined pits and contaminated groundwater and actually killed some of their crops. And the judges ruled in favor of a Central Valley farmer that it had killed some of his orchard trees. And I think this is increasingly what we're seeing is that especially during a time of drought, when farmers are turning more toward groundwater, any place where these industries operate side by side and you've got the potential for contamination.
And who's testing the water?
Well, it's done by a variety of agencies, the Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board. So in California, we have the state is responsible for maintaining water quality, and it's delegated authority to these 9 different regional boards around the state. So the Central Valley Board is responsible. Down through the years, I think the oil and gas industry has maybe not had as much scrutiny on it as it ought to have.
Meaning the water hasn't been tested or they haven't had regulation about how they dispose of their wastewater or in what way?
Well, one of our other guests can talk about one of the things that's come to light in the last few years is that the oil industry has been disposing of wastes in these unlined pits where the wastes, some of them evaporate into the atmosphere, which can create an air quality problem. Some of the wastes actually percolate down into the ground. And they can create a problem with soil and water contamination. And until recently, nobody realized the extent that we were still using this practice to dispose of oil field wastes in California. There are over 900, I believe, is the latest estimate of these ponds that are in operation. Not all of them have permits. Some of them have permits that are very old. And it's a practice that's been either phased out or banned in some of the other major oil-producing states. New Mexico and Texas have both eliminated this practice.
And they're called percolation pits because they're designed to percolate down into the groundwater.
Exactly. Right? They go by different names. Sometimes they're called evaporation percolation pits. Sometimes they're referred to as sumps. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of industry term.
But they're not designed to maintain the water, to protect the water table. They're actually designed to have the chemicals go through into the soil, correct?
It's the oldest form of waste disposal. And in sort of the early years, I think what a lot of people maybe don't know about oil production and gas production in California is that for every gallon of oil that you pump up to the surface, it comes with an average of about 15 gallons of water. And so it creates this tremendous waste stream that needs to be handled and disposed of. And
of course, during a drought, we need that water. So
it's also potentially a resource. So my colleagues and I at the Pacific Institute have been encouraging more water reuse and recycling for years. And it's something that within California we've been doing with sewage. Municipal wastewater is recycled and reused to grow crops all across the state in dozens of places. And it turns out we've also been reusing oil wastewater. You can treat it and reuse it to grow crops or to water livestock. And that's something that's been going on, it turns out, for decades that a lot of people just weren't aware of until recently. It's been sort of a more high-profile issue.
Right, which presumes that it has a certain degree of cleanliness, or at least, maybe Andrew, can you tell us what is in oil wastewater? What do we need to worry about?
Sure. So when you drill for oil, and as Matt said, about 15 times as much water comes out of the ground, a lot of that is naturally occurring water that's in the formation with the oil. And so what happens is the oil company will skim off the oil and send that off to market, and they're left with this water, which has residual oil and hydrocarbons in it. And so you've got chemicals that are commonly associated with oil, such as benzene and other known carcinogens. You can have the presence of heavy metals, other chemicals such as boron, which are known to kill crops. Miriam can probably talk more about some of the health impacts of these chemicals, but there's a wide range of very serious health impacts that can arise from exposure to these chemicals. And so those are just the naturally occurring chemicals. What you've also got is any chemicals that were added into the oil well through any moment in its lifespan. And so from the moment a well is drilled, it needs to be maintained. Oil companies are often using very harsh acids or other chemicals to clean out the well. If you're going to hydraulically fracture or stimulate a well or do some other type of enhanced oil recovery treatment, there are numerous chemicals being added in, many of which do have chemical information, chemical health and safety information, and we know that they're harmful, many of which we do not have full information. And so you've got a huge risk of, you know, any of those chemicals that are added in, as well as any of the naturally occurring chemicals in that wastewater. And so there's a number of things to look out for and be concerned for.
So I read that last year Chevron was recycling about 21 million gallons a day and selling it to farmers who use it on about 10% of Kern County's farmland. Is this a good idea, Miriam? Is this given all those chemicals that are in the oil wastewater, is that safe to put that water on crops to grow food that we're eating?
The trouble right now is that we don't have the information to be able to answer that question, because while, Andrew just listed off some of the chemicals of concern, we have very little information about what's actually in that wastewater. The kind of testing that was done previously of this water were very minimal assessments, how much salt, things that could cause ecological damage, but don't tell you the specific chemicals that could get into groundwater or could harm workers in the fields when that is evaporating into the air and causing a health risk, or they get exposed, they get the chemical on their skin. In addition, just to make it even that much more complicated, there's increasing science that shows the chemicals that are being injected are actually reacting with the chemicals that are under the ground, and that the mix that you get back up may be even more toxic than what you either put down into the ground or that was already there in the first place, which all of that uncertainty means that we need much more stringent testing to be able to answer the question about what risks could be posed. The oil industry likes to use the example that fracking fluids are just like chemicals that are under your kitchen sink. They've told me that. And I don't know about you, but I don't want any of those chemicals in my drinking water. So we need increased scrutiny. That, you know, just thinking that this has been going on for a long time and everything should be okay is just not enough to meet the concerns of communities that live right there and the people that are most impacted.
Do you need to know what chemicals are in the water before you can test to find out whether those chemicals are in the water?
It's much, you know, obviously it's very hard to test for things that you don't know, right? So, and there are a number of screens that one can use to try to capture the universe, given the information we now have in California, thanks to advocacy of communities and folks concerned who said it's not, you know, it's not right that companies should be allowed to inject chemicals into the ground and not tell anybody what they are. So, you know, increasingly we have more information. I wish that information made me more comforted. In fact, it makes me more worried. There are some of those chemicals that have been reported to the state that are injected and which are likely in some of this wastewater are known endocrine disrupting chemicals. Those are chemicals that mimic our natural hormones and can be biologically active at very low levels. This means that something that's at part per billion could actually be quite significant. And we need testing to look for these chemicals in the wastewater, and we need, quite honestly, analysis of the groundwater in the areas where this practice has been taking place. And we need to make sure that that groundwater is safe, whether people use it for irrigation or whether people drink it.
So, and who should be doing that testing? And is it the onus on the industry? Is the onus on the regulators at the state water boards? Matt, who's in charge here?
Sure. Well, right now the testing that's done, it's you know, all these projects are permitted. They have a permit from the state to do this, and they do require some testing. Mostly, it's for salts. So the main concern is that the water would be salty and could harm the crops. And they are required to test for some other chemicals with less frequency. It's industry and their consultants who are taking the samples and, you know, sending them to labs and having these analyses done. So the onus is on industry to do the testing.
And how's that worked so far?
Well, they'll tell you that it's worked fine. And, you know, it very well may be the case that this practice is perfectly safe and poses minimal risk. But like Miriam said, we just do need more information to be able to really reassure customers. You know, California's agricultural sector is worth $40 billion plus. It's a huge, important industry. And I think we owe it to reassure consumers of agricultural products that they're safe and healthy, and also to our farm workers who are already among the most vulnerable. And it's one of the most dangerous jobs in the state as it is. And so that's why I would also agree that we do need some more testing. And there's some real parallels with this. You know, when the state decided that we wanted to reuse sewage for irrigation, we didn't just start doing it before doing the science. We looked before we leapt. And they assembled a blue ribbon science panel to really look at the science behind this issue, to study it, and to determine what kind of testing and what kind of treatment we need. And so we think just that same approach should be used for oil field wastes.
Okay. Now, Andrew, thanks to State Senator Fran Pavley and the hard work of many environmental groups like Clean Water Action, California finally passed SB 4, which regulates fracking and some oil field activity in 2013. Can you tell us what that legislation aimed to do and whether it's succeeding?
Sure. So prior to the passage of Senate Bill 4, the state of California didn't officially regulate hydraulic fracturing or any other form of well stimulation. And when we're talking about well stimulation, we're talking about activities where the geology in the oil field is permanently changed, whether it's through cracking the rock or using acids to bore holes into the formation. And so the state had really no official data on where this was happening, what kind of chemicals were being used, how much water was being used, where the wastewater was going, what's in the wastewater. There was no notification to neighbors. There was no monitoring of nearby aquifers for potential contamination. And so Senate Bill 4 set in motion a number of different policies and programs at the state level, which are currently being implemented, including direct regulation of hydraulic fracturing and other well stimulation activities, so that companies need to go get a permit from the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources. We have a nice acronym. That agency goes by DOGGR for short. The State Water Board is now doing groundwater monitoring in oil fields where hydraulic fracturing and well stimulation are occurring. We're also getting full chemical disclosure of all the chemicals that are used in the well stimulation fluids. And that's really important because in, you know, in a number of states, companies can claim trade secrets and hide some of that information. Here in California, we passed that law, and now companies are fully disclosing the chemicals within the well stimulation fluids. What's a gap, though, is that chemicals used in other oil field activities are not being disclosed. So the routine maintenance, for example, of a well, they don't have to share that information. So that would be another area of concern where we need to expand some of the pieces of Senate Bill 4, get more information for some of the other activities that don't fit into the definition of fracking or well stimulation. And so really, we went in a short period of time from the state not really paying any official attention to fracking to having a fairly robust regulatory scheme to look at the issue. And a number of the pieces are still being developed, and we've still got some questions about how effective they'll be. And just to be clear, it doesn't ensure that this practice is safe, but we're starting to get data and understand where the risks might be and what kind of potential problems with, you know, some more specificity rather than we know that fracking can contaminate groundwater or surface water. Now we're going to know where to look, and we're going to start getting data.
So it's monitoring, basically. Is there anything in the legislation that would, you know, help prevent groundwater contamination?
There are specific requirements on how the frack jobs are performed. There's various geologic reviews that operators have to do prior to getting the permit. So they would need to look for potential underground pathways where fluids could migrate. They need to look for abandoned oil and gas wells, which are another potential pathway. So there's some increased geologic review that does need to happen that will hopefully decrease the risk of those problems. And of course, like any law, it's only as effective as how well it's implemented. So, you know, we're talking about an agency, DOGGR, that was around, that's been around for 100 years now. And I would say for the first 98 years, worked pretty much for the oil industry. And it's really in the last couple that there's been some public accountability and some shifting of the culture at that agency to really work for the public now.
And so that kind of leads back to, Matt, what you were saying about the, what, 900 open percolation pits in California, and only some of them have been permitted. What is the state going to do with the ones that either weren't permitted properly or with the pits in general? I mean, they're
That's a great question, and Andrew can it's thanks to his organization's work and a report that he wrote that there's so much awareness of this issue now. But there is some language in a bill that was introduced in the last legislative session that would phase out the use of these unlined pits. Not clear if that will actually end up being passed into law.
But that's SB 248.
SB 248, that's right. And you know, if we would follow the lead of some other oil-producing states and get rid of essentially what's a risky practice.
But so what happens if we don't use those pits? As I understand it, our choices are to put them into, you know, put the wastewater into these ponds, or to inject it back underground, mm-hmm. or to recycle it. I mean, there seem to be trade-offs with each option.
There absolutely are. Yeah, there's no sort of silver bullet for disposing of this all these wastes.
How safe are injection wells?
Well, they're generally considered to be among the safer options. It needs to be done carefully. So that's majority of the wastewater right now. I think it's about two-thirds is disposed of in these underground injection wells. And these are often former production wells that have been sort of repurposed. And the idea is that if you inject the wastes deep underground, that they'll stay there and that they won't come back up and contaminate soil or groundwater. Now, what we know about the subsurface geology in California is that we've got these faults and things are folded, and it's maybe a little bit more complex than we sort of would at the surface realize.
I've been told that the fault lines look less like lasagna and more like nachos. Is that accurate?
Sure. I'm not sure. I haven't heard that. That's good.
That it's not necessarily stratified, that it's disrupted. And I understand that the fracking that goes on is fairly shallow compared to other states. Now, does that cause problems with the water table if the fracking is done higher than it normally is?
I think that was maybe one of the more surprising findings of the science study that was done as a result of SB4, the law passed in 2013, which required an independent science panel to review the practice and the health and safety and environmental impacts. Looking at the data, the scientists realized that there were hundreds of hydraulic fractures had been conducted at depths of less than 2,000 feet, so less than a half mile, so awfully close to the surface and awfully close to the level where we are getting water for irrigation and for water supply.
So that increased the risks of contamination.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right. That's it's important to note that science study had quite a long list of recommendations and that their task was to review both the science around hydraulic fracturing, around oil and gas stimulation, the provisions under SB4, and to look at whether that was adequate for protecting the environment and public health in California. And their conclusion was that there was quite a bit more to be done, whether it was the shallowness of where the fracturing was occurring, whether it was the disposal methods. Some of this underground, these injection wells have been found to be have been improperly located in terms of where they're disposing. Our underground injection control program in the state of California has extensive problems and needs reform. We don't have the right kind of monitoring to ensure the integrity of those old wells, whether they're going to make sure that that wastewater is disposed of properly, make sure we know where it's going, make sure it's not going to be contaminating any water resource. And, I think it's important just to make, a note of the fact that oil is a limited resource. There's a lot of resources going in. There's a lot of risk coming out. I think it's very important for all of us to be considering not only what are the regulatory practices necessary to keep everybody safe, but is this where California wants to be investing for its future?
I want to unpack. You brought up a lot of issues that I want to unpack, but right now I want to get to remind everyone this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight we're discussing whether California is doing enough to protect its groundwater from contamination. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Do you have concerns about fracking or oil and gas extraction? The number to join to call our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website or on our Facebook page. So you brought up a lot of issues, Miriam. I guess, the proximity of population to these wells, I think it's something like I think there's almost 2 million people in L.A. who live or work within 1 mile of an active oil or gas well. What kind of effects might those residents have from being so close to those kinds of activities?
Unfortunately, there's a long list of health threats coming from oil and gas, and proximity in terms, how close you are certainly puts you at greater risk. It's not the only way you can be at risk. Whether contaminated groundwater or even air contamination, regional contamination can cause harm, at distance. But for those communities who are at the front lines, living right up against this polluting industry, those risks are very real. One of the recommendations that was in that scientific report was to note that California does not have a state law that describes how far homes should be from oil and gas. There are a lot of distances and none of them are sufficient. And we need protections for communities. Distance is one of the ways. It's not the only way. But what was once an empty lot far from the town center, 100 years ago, are now many metropolitan urban areas. And communities face risks from air contamination. They face risk from water contamination. Many of these sites are loud and noisy, and they have odor. There's a lot of nuisance, and nuisance, I think, demeans what that means. Very, you know, light pollution, sound pollution can be very, very stressful, and can have significant impacts in conjunction with chemical exposures.
So setback requirements would be one of the things that you think should happen.
Long overdue in California.
Right. Okay. So, Andrew, what are the prospects of SB 248, which I understand is still in committee? What are the prospects of this legislation coming out of the legislature?
Sure. So Senate Bill 248 is a two-year bill, and so we're now just moving into the second year of the current legislative session. That bill will not be coming up again until the summer, probably in June. And so we're going to have to wait and see at that point what's going on in the legislature. And there's it's hard to predict what that body will do. There's a lot of industry power and influence on a number of legislators, and so it's an uphill battle passing bills that the oil industry does not like. They are the largest spender in Sacramento. In just the last quarter of the last year's legislative session in 2015, the oil industry spent $11 million on lobbying expenses in the final quarter, by far the most of any industry.
That was probably evident in SB 350, I'm guessing. It's part of the reason that the governor had to back off on his pledge to remove a certain amount of carbon emissions from the...
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
The list of bills that the oil industry has killed is quite long.
Okay. but will SB 248, will that help address it'll help phase out the ponds that are in use right now, I guess, which by definition are supposed to put those chemicals in the air, right? They're supposed to evaporate the chemicals out, which must contribute to the poor air quality in the Central Valley, right?
That's one of the goals of the bill as it's currently written. Like I said, we're a number of months away from this bill seeing another vote. So some things may change and some other bills may be introduced that could address some of the issues. But currently, as it is written, SB 248 does address the ponds. It also requires the full chemical disclosure, which is a key data set that we're missing right now to make get better information and make sure things are safer.
And then once we have that list, Miriam, we'll be better able to identify what kinds of health effects to look for or to expect from the chemicals that are active in this?
It's an important data set, certainly, for figuring out what testing we need and for figuring out where to target our testing and how to make sure that the water that is being reused is safe for that purpose. And certainly, we don't need the data on what's in those ponds to get to end that practice. It is a very old school method that shouldn't still be allowed in the 2016 in California to use a pit to actually put this water into the ground is definitely not 21st century.
Right. But if that water winds up being recycled, I mean, what happens to those crops? Can plants take up these toxins or do they filter them out? How do we know that our produce that's being grown in these crops that are being irrigated with oil, wastewater, are safe to eat?
Some compounds can be taken up by plants. Heavy metals are the best example of that. Arsenic, people may have heard of the arsenic in rice. There are some plants and some metals that are known to be taken up, can be incorporated into the plant themselves. There are other compounds also. And it's part of why close scrutiny is needed of any chemical that would be used in irrigation water. There are also compounds that do break down. The hydrocarbon compound, so what's in oil itself, that's decayed plant matter to start with. So it will, under good conditions, break down. That doesn't mean that that's what's happening in these fields. And so we do need to make sure that the amount that are being applied, if there are trace amounts of hydrocarbons left, that they are being, broken down by the microbes. They ought, oil and gas uses a lot of biocides. These are compounds intended to alter or kill the microbial community. So we need to make sure when people are sort of saying, well, the microbial community is going to take care of these hydrocarbons, that that's indeed true and that we haven't, that we haven't altered the chemical composition through the water so that that's not the case. All these gaps need to be kind of filled to answer that question.
And what about livestock? Same concerns, different concerns? Are they the, you know, if livestock is drinking the water that is, say, recycled from these?
Lots of, I mean, in terms of, there's definitely a ton of concerns for the health of that animal because they're going to be inhaling those compounds in addition to drinking them directly. The question of what can contaminate meat is a more complicated question and really depends on the chemistry of the compounds of what that we're talking about. And, you know, on the farmer side of all this, people, you know, they should have access to information. They should have access to water that is suitable for what they need to do, whether that's raise livestock or whether it's grow crops, so that it's all healthy. I mean, you know, we should be in this position of having to guess, you know, is it okay? Or maybe it's okay. Or maybe it's okay on Tuesdays. But, you know, sometimes it smells really bad. And that's, right. You know, that's what you hear from people who live near where this water is being used or who are responsible for cleaning out some of these pits or sumps. Sumps might be one of my favorite words because it's sort of just unlined container, you know, is the sort of definition of what a sump is. Makes it sound all technical, but really not a pit is a better word.
This is City Visions. If you're just joining us, and we're on local public radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing whether California is doing enough to protect its groundwater from contamination. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. If you have concerns about fracking or oil and gas extraction, I have a panel of experts here that are happy to answer your questions. The call-in number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on kalw.org, or on our Facebook page at City Visions. So that, you know, so what impacts might we expect, you know, in the Bay Area? Affected by the oil and gas industry here? I know there's a lot of refineries in the East Bay. Will we be helped by any of this legislation? Andrew?
There's a number of ways that we could be impacted. You mentioned refineries. The other is transportation of crude oil by rail or other methods, shipping. You know, the oil has to get to the refinery. So that's one aspect. What I would say, you know, we're focusing on oil production in this conversation mostly. And so just, you know, California is a statewide water system. And if you contaminate groundwater in Kern County, it has an impact on the rest of the state. You know, in a normal year, about 40% of people rely on groundwater for their drinking water. And if you take away or contaminate that source, they'll need to get it from somewhere else. And so if that's surface water, that means draining more water from the Delta in Northern California as climate is changing and getting warmer, and we can't count as much on snowpack, for example. You know, where that water is going to come from is a big question mark that really all Californians should be concerned about. So even though, you know, it may sound like, oh, this is a Kern County issue, this doesn't affect, you know, me up in the Bay Area, I would, you know, disagree with that and say we really all have a lot invested in this.
How do you remediate groundwater contamination?
Well, the most effective way is to not let it happen. That's by far the cheapest and most effective way. And so pollution prevention is by far the top priority, and that's why a cautious approach is definitely what's needed. If groundwater does become contaminated, it's very costly and difficult and time-consuming to clean up. You know, there are methods like pumping and treating. You know, we would want to see if an oil company pollutes groundwater that they are the ones responsible and paying for the cleanup. That burden should not fall on the communities who are impacted. It should not be passed on in the form of, you know, rate hikes to consumers. It shouldn't be paid for by our tax dollars. And so, you know, you end up getting into these battles about who pays for things, and really the best course of action would be to stop it before it happens.
I read that farmer that you're talking about, Matt, that sued over his almond orchards that were killed by the wastewater, that he was awarded in the millions of dollars. It was like something like $8.7 million or something.
That's right.
But he estimated the damages, I think, in the billions because his groundwater source was contaminated.
Yeah,
is that right?
That's right. When he appealed the decision asking for a larger sum of money, it was, I think, closer to $3 billion because that was his estimated price tag for actually cleaning up the contaminated groundwater. beneath this process, beneath this property. It's a slow and expensive process.
So I'm guessing that in that instance, the groundwater has not been cleaned up. He was probably compensated for losing his crops, but not for the loss of the groundwater source, which is, you know, his livelihood. And
that's right.
And that's where he lives.
And if I could add just one thing to the last question, you know, you're asking how are people in the Bay Area, you know, we're a little disconnected from, there's not oil and gas production in the Bay Area. It's largely in the San Joaquin County. There's some gas wells up in the Sacramento Valley north of here. But one of the farmers that I talked to when we were doing this research for our study on oil, food, and water in the state said, you know, 100 years from now, we may no longer be using oil, but do you think we'll still need to eat food?
Well, and given that California produces half the produce for the country, it's not even just a California issue. It's a nationwide issue.
That's right. I think we all consume, you know, nuts and fruit and vegetables from the Central Valley. And so we want to make sure that we're maintaining clean water and clean soil to produce these really valuable commodities and also a big cornerstone of our economy.
Right. So what about that, Andrew? If we go back to the legislation that's working its way through Sacramento, will that impact jobs? Will that impact the oil industry in general?
Specifically, Senate Bill 248. I don't have any projections on if that would or would not impact it. You can be sure that the oil industry and the California Chamber of Commerce will tell you that it is a job killer bill. I have not seen any evidence of, these common sense regulations, you know, really baseline, minimal regulations hurting industry so much. A much bigger threat to oil industry jobs is the low price of oil right now. and the fact that, you know, we're hopefully going to stop needing oil. And, the real growth opportunity is in alternatives and renewables, and that's where we should be focusing and growing our economy in clean forms of energy rather than dirty ones.
Well, and what about that argument that we should leave it in the ground, that it shouldn't be coming out anyway? Wouldn't that do away with a lot of the issues that are raised here?
Yeah, it's pollution prevention right at the beginning.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's see. We have callers. One question that's been raised is organic produce free of this risk?
That's a great question, and this is Matt from the Pacific Institute. That was one of the issues that we looked at in our recent study, and it turns out that there are organic farms in California that are irrigating their crops with recycled wastewater from oil fields, and there's nothing that's in the organic certification that prevents that. And it turns out the organic certification actually doesn't have anything to say about water quality or the source of water. And so, you know, you're not allowed to have genetically modified organisms. You're not allowed to use antibiotics or synthetic fertilizers or pesticides. But in terms of using water that was recycled from Chevron's oil fields, That's
interesting. Well, who is testing that water to make sure it's safe? Is that purely the industry that's looking at that?
Yeah, in terms of the testing, it's industry and their consultants that are taking the samples and sending them to labs and having them analyzed.
But clearly with the case of the almond farmer that we were talking about earlier, I mean, that water was not clean that was used on his orchard.
Yeah, I mean, farmers are not – they're not chemists.
No, they test for pests. They don't necessarily test for –
Yeah, they're not chemists. They're not public health experts. I mean, they're experts at growing food. They're not necessarily experts in
– So the regional water boards then
– That's right.
– are responsible for this?
They're the ones that are responsible for setting the timetable for how many tests are required and what things need to be tested for. That's right.
So if the ponds are phased out, then the wastewater disposal issue is not going to go away. So then the other two remaining pathways are recycling that water or injecting it deeper underground. Sort of both.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, the problem's only going to get bigger over time because the percentage of water that's coming up out of the ground, that's what the industry calls the water cut. So how much water there is for every gallon of oil, it's only increasing. So
because the oil wells are maturing and there's less oil down there.
That's right.
Get.
There's less and less oil, and so we're getting a greater proportion of water. So the waste disposal stream is it's going to be an even bigger problem in the future.
Right, and there's going to be more and more pressure to use that water because of, if the drought continues and water becomes a scarcer and that more scarce resource, that there's going to be pressure to reuse that. Are there ways, Miriam, to clean out the chemicals from the water?
There are treatment systems. Certainly, it's actually not that challenging to get rid of hydrocarbons before it gets underground. We talked about that may not be the only risk, so I don't want to suggest that we only do that, kind of treatment. That's well known in the oil industry and other places. They do that prior to use or to disposal of wastewater. That is something that's important. You could imagine that there is a treatment process and with a proper testing regime that provides a fair amount of confidence for any purchaser of that water or any user of that water that it meets certain specifications. And, they may be a slightly different if you're not being applied to a food crop or if they're applied to an area that doesn't have a risk of water contamination. It's not, this can be done. In other industries, we really strictly review wastewater. We don't allow it to be just sort of willy-nilly used or willy-nilly disposed of. This industry has gotten sort of some special deals over the years. And one of the real places that it has gotten, is in waste disposal. And they're allowed to do things that other industries are not allowed to do, certainly not allowed to do without extensive testing. And we really need to see that special treatment go away. This is a polluting industry, and it should be treated as such.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go to our callers. We have a caller, Kristen. Welcome to City Visions.
Hi.
Do you have a question for one of our guests?
Yes. First I want to say I'm enjoying the conversation and all the information, so thank you for the panelists.
Great.
And all the information, it sounds like the gas and oil industry in California just has such power with a huge amount of money behind it, and with these special interests. So I'm wondering if there is any organizing going on in the agriculture. Like, is there agriculture and farmers that are organized and lobbying to counter that of the gas and oil industry, especially since agriculture has such a huge monetary stake in California, not just health stake, but really monetary stake?
That's a good question. Andrew Grinberg, Clean Water Action.
Sure. So we're starting to see some small farmers rise up a little bit against what's going on with the oil industry. And there was recently a lawsuit down in Kern County where a group of farmers actually sued the Kern County Board of Supervisors for passing a new zoning ordinance that could fast-track oil and gas production. And they saw that as a threat to their farmland. However, what we have not seen is big ag take on the oil industry. And in Sacramento in the halls of power throughout the country, big ag is one of the most powerful industry groups as well, along with big oil and gas. So you've got two of the behemoths with immense lobbying power, immense influence. And I don't think that they want to go head to head. And so what we've largely seen is those two industries kind of scratch each other's back and stay out of each other's way. So you're not going to get the California Farm Bureau trying to shut down the oil industry. And so that's just not a dynamic that we've seen yet. Who knows what the future may hold. If, there are some, many more confirmed cases of contamination, you might see a little more of that. But to date, you won't see those two industries taking each other on.
That would be an interesting fight. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. Our number to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website or on our Facebook page. That's one thing that we haven't really gotten to is talking about why the oil industry has certain exemptions. I understand fracking has been sort of specifically exempted. They call it the Halliburton exemption from the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And
the Safe Drinking Water Act.
Can someone talk about how that came about and why that's allowed to remain?
Well, I think that the explanation is probably fairly simple. They sort of call it the Dick Cheney loophole, which was that Dick Cheney was an executive at Halliburton, which is one of the leading providers of fracking fluid and oil field services. And it was really just in their economic interest to not regulate this with a great deal of scrutiny. And the oil industry enjoys all sorts of loopholes and exemptions. And you could maybe consider in the 1970s when we were really struggling with our energy security, and maybe if oil production was far away from where everyone lived and you had this sacrifice zone, is a word that I don't particularly like, but that's not the case in California. You know, oil production takes place on our farm fields or right next to it, and in the case of Los Angeles, right in the middle of neighborhoods and you know, near schools and old folks' homes and all sorts of things, not in a sacrifice zone.
Well, and what is the percentage of Californians that rely on groundwater for their drinking water?
It's about 40% in most years and higher during drought years.
So it is sort of surprising.
It's a critical resource.
That an entire industry would be exempt from and it's not the Safe Drinking Water Act?
It's not just the Safe Drinking Water Act. It's the toxics regulations, and it's the way we regulate hazardous chemicals. And so there's been increasingly calls to close some of these loopholes.
And will that happen in California, do you think, Andrew?
Well, so those are federal laws, and so California can't specifically close the loopholes. What we can do is enact policies that do some of the same things. And so the Halliburton loophole, when you're specifically talking about the Safe Drinking Water Act and exempting fracking from it, means that you do not have to get a permit to frack a well from the federal government. So when we passed Senate Bill 4, we did take care of that aspect of the Halliburton loophole. You know, we could debate whether or not it was good enough to, you know, compensate for that gaping federal gap. And we should also just acknowledge that the Safe Drinking Water Act and making fracking fall under that would not make it safe specifically. It would just mean that there's more federal oversight and, you know, making sure that the federal government is getting all the information that it needs and should be getting.
So speaking of the differences between the federal and state laws, I read that there were, because of the discrepancies for the definitions of clean water, there was wastewater that was reinjected back into wells that that should not have been receiving that water. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Who wants Andrew?
Sure. So Dogger, the agency I flagged earlier, the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, is the permitting agency for all oil and gas wells. And what we're talking about right now is injection wells, and that includes disposal of wastewater and also includes wells where operate oil and gas companies inject water or steam to enhance the production in an oil field. And Dogger improperly permitted thousands of wells in places that maybe they shouldn't have. And about 500 of those were disposal wells where they permitted the disposal of wastewater into aquifers that may be suitable to be used as drinking water sources. And Dogger has since closed down about 50 of those wells, and the rest of them are under review. And so they've got until February of 2017 to either close those wells or to grant what's called an aquifer exemption and basically rule out the use of using that aquifer for drinking water sources. But there are, you know, the 50 wells that they've closed, they determined that it's highly likely that that water could be used for drinking water either currently or in the future. And it, you know, it really just calls into question how smart it is to exempt an aquifer. What we know is we need to protect every drop of water that we've got, and we're going to rely more and more on groundwater, and we're going to have to rely on lower quality groundwater and likely have to treat more of it. So writing off an aquifer because it's maybe a little too salty for us to drink today without treatment and saying, okay, oil industry, you can go ahead and pump, you know, benzene and toluene into this aquifer, and, you know, these are known carcinogens. In 50 years, are we going to look back and say, wow, that was a really bad idea? Or are we going to protect those aquifers? And, you know, if we have to rely on them, we'll be protected.
But what do we do with that wastewater then? I mean, if we're phasing out the percolation pits and we don't allow it to be reinjected into the water, and we don't really want to put it on crops or with those chemicals in it, then where does that wastewater go?
Sure. Well, just to be clear, the injection of wastewater is not necessarily a problem. It's a problem when it's done in the wrong place and when it's injected into a high-quality aquifer. What I would also say is the onus should be on the industry to figure out what to do with their waste. If they can't figure out a safe way to dispose of it, then maybe they shouldn't produce it at all. And, you know, we're talking about an industry with so many problems. This is just one in a long list, and that includes, you know, the climate change aspect, air quality, water quality. And when you add it all up, you start to question whether or not it's a good idea to be producing oil here at all.
But there are thousands of these wells, right? I mean, Matt, what do we know enough about the legacy pollution from orphaned oil wells that have been abandoned? And what happens to all these holes in the ground?
Well, that's a great question. What we've learned from reviewing some of the records is that these old wells that have stopped production, they can be potential pathways that contamination can move from deep underground into soil or into groundwater. And there are actually over 100,000 oil wells. We've had over 100 years of oil production in the state.
100,000 in California.
That's right, yeah. And so, you know, they've been closed. A lot of times they pour cement into the wells to close them. But we know that over time it could crack, or, you know, the metal casings for these wells that were built 50 years ago maybe have rusted or various things. So it's definitely a cause for concern. It's one of the recommendations we made in our report is that there should be a better inventory of these and more study to really look at the areas where there's high-quality groundwater that needs to be protected.
And you guys took a pretty thorough look in the study that you set out. What surprised you the most when you were putting this together?
Oh, that's another good question. I would say the question of how livestock in particular are allowed to come into contact with some of these waste streams. I read a case study of, I think it was in Louisiana, where there was a fracking fluid spill, and the cattle were sick and eventually were sent to slaughter, and they sort of become an indistinguishable part of the food supply. So, you know, when you're buying hamburger, and is that a part of it? You know, and in 2010, when we had the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, you know, they closed the fisheries for a reason. And it's because we know that when the fish are swimming in oily water, that they absorb contaminants into their flesh, and it's not safe to eat. And so they had a whole screening protocol. And so I'm not sure why we haven't sort of made this connection to do the same thing with cattle or with sheep. If you go out to the Central Valley, you can see, you know, the pump jacks, and then right next to it, cattle grazing on that land.
I would imagine the air emissions alone might have an impact on that. Miriam, do you?
And it's certainly, and across the country, farmers have been worried about this. In many cases, you know, California is somewhat unique in terms of having the impact in our urban areas in terms of the LA area. But across the country, if you talk to communities that are, you know, in harm's way from oil and gas, the concern of farmers, the concern about their livestock, you'll hear many, many stories about unexplained illnesses in cattle or other kinds of livestock. You hear it throughout the mountainous West. You hear it, you know. It's difficult to really pinpoint the concerns, not knowing exactly what the exposures are. And again, you know, sort of we have big gaping holes in the information. What are cattle breathing? What are people breathing? You know, there are schools, right? Chain link fence separates them from an oil field. And we don't know what those children are breathing. We know that their parents are worried. We know that the kids have breathing problems. We know that they often complain of illnesses that are similar to exposures that we might be worried about in terms of the kinds of compounds, the volatile organic compounds. But we don't test. We aren't out there making sure that those environments are safe for people or for animals.
Right. I mean, we can test the nitrogen in the air, right, or the VOCs, but in groundwater, I guess if you don't have regular testing going on, then you wouldn't necessarily know what you're ingesting if you're in those areas.
You know, it's the same, whether it's an air quality issue or water quality issue. We don't have the information in order to understand what people are exposed to.
And will these concerns be addressed, Andrew, do you think, in SB 248? you know, how much further can the state go, or what else does the state need to do here to make sure that, you know, people are safe?
I would say we've got a long way to go. And the more we learn about the oil and gas industry, the more we learn about the problems that it presents. And so, you know, just a few years ago in 2011, we actually did not even know that there was fracking happening in California. The state agency, Dogger, said that it was not. And then it turned out, oh, well, no, they've actually been doing it for 50 years. So for me to say that a bill will address the problems of the oil industry would be really short-sighted. And I'm sure we're going to continue to find new things. We just found out about, you know, how widespread the use of these wastewater pits was. We just found out, you know, how poorly the permitting process was going on the injection wells. And so I would imagine that the more scrutiny from the public and from responsible state agencies, and the closer that they look and the more monitoring there is, the more problems we're going to find. And that's why we've got to ramp up enforcement. We've got to fund these agencies adequately, and we've got to update the rules to really match what's actually going on in oil fields today, and not rely on these outdated rules and practices of, you know, turning a blind eye like we've historically done here.
Well, and the information is just starting to come in, right, from SB4 in July 2015, I think some of the data started coming in. Or
we've had a number of different, you know, rounds of data come in, you know, as the rules have been developed. And yes, we're just starting to learn and see some of the trends. There's another bill, SB 1281, also from Senator Fran Pavley, that requires disclosure of the disposal methods and the water sources used in oil production activities. And we're just, you know, only had a couple of rounds of reporting on that. And so we'll be getting more information thanks to some of the, you know, good policies that we've enacted, but it's certainly not enough, and we need to keep, you know, diving deeper and figuring out ways to address the issues.
Okay. Any last recommendations, Miriam, for the state? Action to take needs to be taken?
The scientific review, it's, you know, not a quick read. The executive summary was like 30 pages or something. But, you know, it lays out a number of really strong policies, whether it's banning the pits or telling the industry that you can't use chemicals unless you can show that they're not going to cause harm. I mean, that is the kind of policies that we need to prevent the kind of harms and the problems that we've been talking about. We need policies that shift this over away from the public bearing the brunt of, you know, chasing this industry. They know, and they have the money. This industry should be showing us how they could be doing this safely and proving it. And we should shift the standard. That's the way that we're going to get the public health protections we needed.
Matt, any last word?
Sure. Yeah, I think just what's happening here in California, we're not alone. You know, it's symptomatic of we have a toxics problem in this country. Our laws for regulating toxic chemicals are woefully out of date. And so that's something we have to handle at a federal level. And if we can't handle it in California, we've got a Democratic majority in both houses of our legislature and a Democratic governor who wants to be an environmental leader. So California really needs to lead the way on this issue and be an example.
Okay. Well, that is City Visions for this evening. My guests were Matt Heberger, Senior Research Associate in the Water Program at the Pacific Institute, Andrew Grinberg, the Oil and Gas Program Manager in the California Office of Clean Water Action, and Miriam Rockin-Ellman, Staff Scientist in the Health Program of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Tonight's show is produced by yours truly, Ann Harper, and in the studio by Joseph Pache. Thank you to Debbie, our engineer, and join us next time on City Visions. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.